The poet Robert Frost once remarked that George Washington was one of the few men in all of human history who was not carried away by power. Washington probably could have become king of America if he'd wanted to. There were those who thought he did. Instead, America's first general became the United States' first two-term civilian president, something a world familiar only with hereditary monarchs had never seen. Napoleon, as he lay dying on St. Helena, condemned for having seized the power of an emperor, complained that his critics wanted me to be another Washington. Beneath the marble veneer of the figurehead, the man who has become namesake to thousands of young men, small towns, high schools, the nation's capital, and the 42nd state, whose image is reproduced endlessly on coins, currency, and stamps, whose portrait now hangs in nearly every museum and public building, in whose honor a towering white obelisk was raised on the Capitol Mall, and a huge bust carved into a South Dakota mountain, we find a man seeking to belong, longing for acceptance and respect, hiding his insecurities behind a mask of aloofness, struggling with a sense of his own inadequacies. Rejected as a British officer at age 24, by age 42, the once loyal British subject had become Britain's arch enemy. Washington risked everything to lead his nation's against all odds struggle for independence. Had he failed, he would have been hung as a traitor. In triumph, however, this dignified and self-possessed 6'2" son of Virginia became a great man. Perhaps the greatest man of his age. A man we still call the father of a country. George Washington's Virginia was a world in which wealth, power, and family connections defined one's status. He inherited none of these. And yet through hard work, self-cultivation, a fortunate marriage, and a lifetime of public service, he lifted himself from the lesser rungs of Virginia society to its summit. Mason Locke Weems, an Episcopal clergyman and sometime bookseller, is the source of some of those often pious stories about George Washington, like chopping down his father's cherry tree and tossing coins across swollen rivers.
None of those are true. The cherry tree myth started in a biography that appeared after Washington's death by Parson Mason Weems, and very little is known about Washington's childhood, so he simply made up stories that illustrated the qualities that Washington exhibited as an adult, such as honesty. There's a very good source for the silver dollar myth. George Washington raised his wife's two grandchildren and two children, and the grandson near the end of his life wrote his memoirs in which he said that George Washington could throw a piece of slate the size and shape of a dollar across the river. The river he was referring to is the Rappahannock River, which near the site of the Washington homestead was about 250 feet across. The Potomac here at Mount Vernon is a mile and a quarter, so that would have been some toss. But those are the three big myths, and it's interesting to talk about, but it's we'd like people to look beyond those myths and see the real George Washington.
The real George Washington was born in a modest farmhouse in Westmoreland County, Virginia, on February 22, 1732, the first child of a middle-aged father's second wife. At mid-18th century, Virginia was a province of the British Empire. Its sparse population of mostly English descent saw themselves as Englishmen, subjects of the king. But the British saw Virginians as crude colonists, second class in every way. Within Virginia itself, at the peak of power were the families of the wealthy planters and others of much lesser wealth and property, which included George Washington. Washington spent his early years on small farms along the Potomac and Rappahannock rivers, in sight of, but never totally within the embrace of, Virginia's well-born, well-heeled elite. His father, Augustine, died when he was 11. George inherited a farmhouse left in trust to his mother, Mary. But the bulk of Augustine Washington's estate, including the sizable plantation at Mount Vernon, went to his older half-brother, Lawrence. Unlike Lawrence, who had been educated in England, George's formal education ended when he was 14. To George, Lawrence represented everything he hoped to be. Cultivated, sophisticated, and rich. Lawrence became George's surrogate father, offering guidance and contact with the prominent Fairfax family into which Lawrence had married. The rough adolescent learned his social graces by quietly watching and imitating those in Lawrence's charmed circle. Acutely aware of his own lack of sophistication, fearful of social missteps, he developed lifelong habits of social reserve. He studied books on manners. He read English magazines and translations of Roman classics so that he would have something to say at dinner parties. But to become one of the elite, he needed to make money. By 17, he was working as a frontier surveyor in the Blue Ridge Mountains. At 18, he bought his first piece of land.
Washington, like all Virginians, needed land. Land was the most valuable commodity in an agrarian society. They needed land to replenish their tobacco fields, which wore out in 4 to 8 years. They needed land for speculative purposes, for a rainy day. It was the one form of inheritance they could pass on that would be of great value to their offspring.
During a trip to Barbados with Lawrence when he was 19, George contracted smallpox. It would scar his face for life, but it would also save him by immunizing him to the disease which would ravage his ragged American troops 25 years later. By the time Washington was 20, his carefully cultivated connection with the Fairfaxes led to an appointment as an officer of the Virginia Militia. As a new and inexperienced officer, it would not be long before Washington found himself embroiled in his first military campaign. A smoldering Cold War between England and France, fueled by conflicting land claims on two continents, hit a flashpoint in the Ohio Valley, just over the mountains from Virginia. In Europe, the conflict was called the Seven Years' War. In North America, it was known as the French and Indian Wars. As a 20-year-old major of the Virginia Militia, Washington's job was to train civilians for war. Unfortunately, he had neither the skills nor the knowledge he was expected to teach. But in typical 18th century fashion, he made up for his lack of practical experience by learning from books. The rest he was expected to make up as he went along. In the fall of 1753, England sent Washington, accompanied by 2 translators and 4 backwoodsmen, to warn the French off its territory. In his first mission as a British colonial officer, Washington managed to embarrass himself in an attempt at French-Indian negotiations, almost froze to death crossing an icy river, and was nearly murdered by his Indian guide. On his second foray into the field, ignoring the fact that England and France were not at war, Washington staged what he described as an Indian attack on a small French camp. Of the 10 killed, 1 was the French diplomatic envoy. The French court branded him an assassin. Those Indian tribes still allied with the English, having witnessed the ineptitude of Washington's militia in action, promptly went over to the French. It was an inauspicious beginning.
Washington's attack on the French in western Pennsylvania, the battle in which he is alleged to have assassinated his opponent, was one of those fairly early episodes where he walked onto the pages of history. Actually, he was criticized by the French, but in fact, people in Virginia defended him. People in England defended him. And indeed, the French commander himself had the authority to use force if necessary if the English or the Virginia militiamen confronted him. So Washington has probably taken something of a bad rap here.
The first real battle between the British and French was engaged at Fort Necessity near present-day Pittsburgh. Though eventually surrounded, and despite losing nearly 1/3 of his men, Washington fought on and refused to surrender. The French commander, who was the brother of the dead envoy, finally called a ceasefire and allowed Washington's troops to go home. Washington signed a document legitimizing the French attack as revenge for the death of its envoy. Despite his less than stellar performance, Washington received no criticism from his superiors for his actions. Later, at a battle at Fort Duquesne, he demonstrated that what he lacked in strategic ability he more than made up for in sheer bravery when he had 2 horses shot from under him. 3 years later, again at Fort Duquesne, 2 groups of Virginia militiamen stumbled upon one another in the wilderness and mistakenly opened fire on each other. Washington rode between opposing lines, knocking away guns on both sides with his sword. 14 were killed, 26 were wounded. Washington wasn't touched. At age 24, he returned to the Tidewater, a hero to his fellow Virginians. But when he sought a commission as a full British officer, not just as a colonial officer, he was rudely rejected.
The young Washington commanding a 350-mile line on the Virginia frontier with his so-called Virginia Regiment thought of himself as anything but a partisan or a guerrilla. He wanted to build a regiment that was modeled after the British kind of unit. He insisted that his men be uniform, that his officers read British drill manuals, and they received some wonderful compliments from British officers in the Forbes campaign who served with Washington's regiment. So he thought of himself as anything but a frontier soldier. He wanted to be a British officer, and he wanted a British commission, but he never got one.
He resigned from the militia in protest. Denied advancement in the British Army, he realized that if he was to make his mark in the world, he would have to do it as a civilian. George's brother Lawrence had died in 1752. A few years later, George became the owner of Mount Vernon, which, though substantial, was nothing at all like the grand plantation it would eventually become. The house was a simple story and a half. There were few slaves and indentured workers to run the farm. Washington had lots of land, but little money to work it with, and he was alone. For 10 years, he had wooed a succession of young women, all of whom had rejected him. Some because he wasn't rich enough, and some because they were put off by his diffident personality. He had, however, fallen in love with the wife of George William Fairfax, his Mount Vernon neighbor, his mentor, and one of Washington's few close friends. George had met Sally Fairfax when he was 16 and she 18. Sally was dark, witty, and cuttingly charming, a belle of the Tidewater, able to quote great philosophers and discuss the classics with governors and statesmen over punch. Sally had taken it upon herself to groom the rough 16-year-old in the social graces, and he had fallen madly in love. He sent her love letters. She replied carefully, unwilling to risk her standing by becoming involved. Anything more than friendship with Sally was impossible.
Well, I know Sally Fairfax always comes into the act when George Washington is mentioned, and I think there's no doubt that he had a great affection for her. The whole context of the Fairfax family, the patrons of himself, helped in Washington's advancement, and his own childhood had been not as elegant. After all, the Washingtons were, shall we say, second-tier Tidewater aristocracy, where the Fairfaxes were first-tier aristocracy. And Washington, as a young man, was so impressed, and Sally was bright. She was well-educated, well-read. She was a gardener. They loved to talk about gardening. He mentions that in one of his letters. But it must be said that the Fairfaxes and the Washingtons were close friends. And during the time that they were together on adjoining estates, there was much visiting back and forth.
Still pining for Sally, George was introduced to Martha Custis, a 27-year-old widow and mother of two. Martha Dandridge Custis was 5 foot tall, with a pleasant appearance, was slightly plump, shy, and serious, universally liked and easy to talk to. She was also one of the wealthiest marriageable women in all of Virginia. Her husband, Daniel Custis, had left her 17,000 acres of tobacco, hundreds of slaves, and several farms. While Martha managed the estate herself, she also understood the advantage of having an energetic partner. And while there were many things George Washington was not, he was energetic. The two had only spent 20-some hours together before George proposed marriage. Within the year, they were married, having spent only 15 days in one another's company. In marrying Martha Custis, Washington finally entered the world of the Virginia elite.
She was extremely supportive of him. She complimented him in many ways. She socialized more easily than Washington did, liked to talk with friends and greet them, whereas Washington was a little bit shy. And his size was intimidating. He used to frighten the children. But we're told that Mrs. Washington grabbed him by his lapels and pulled him right down to her face when she wanted to talk to him.
As tobacco prices fell and they saw their debts mounting, George and Martha faced a dilemma. Washington was fearful of going into debt, but equally fearful of what others might think if he were unable to maintain his style of life. If he economized, he said, Such an alteration in the system of my living will create suspicions of a decay in my fortune, and such a thought the world must not harbor. Image was all important. Washington saw his and his fellow planters' problem as one of dependence on their English agents. The men who sold Virginia's tobacco in Europe and who purchased finished goods on their behalf in London. Washington decided to stop growing labor-intensive, soil-depleting tobacco and grow grains instead. He was soon selling his produce in Alexandria and buying finished goods from local importers and American manufacturers instead of buying through the London agents. Within a decade, he was out of debt and a firm believer in American economic independence. And as the British Parliament levied one burdensome tax after another on the colonies, Washington began to see advantages in American political independence as well. Washington wrote to Brian Fairfax, Sally's brother in England, "I think the Parliament of Great Britain hath no more right to put their hands in my pocket without my consent than I have to put my hand into yours for money." Soon, Washington joined Patrick Henry as one of the most influential members of the Virginia House of Burgesses. As relations between Britain and the colonies deteriorated, Virginia sent Washington as one of its representatives to the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia. By the time the Second Continental Congress convened 1 year later, fighting had broken out between the Massachusetts Minutemen and British regulars. To symbolize the depth of his commitment to the cause of resistance, Washington arrived in Philadelphia wearing his military uniform. John Adams nominated George Washington as commander-in-chief of the army, which would wage the war for national independence. His election was unanimous.
Washington was actually a very good choice to command the American army. He had commanded a significant portion of men in the French and Indian War. He had as much experience in that war, good experience, as any American, probably better. He had served in the Virginia legislature after that for 17 years, so he knew the legislative mind, and throughout the war he had to deal with Congress, a legislative body. And in fact, military theory and doctrine had changed very little in the 17 years since he had taken off his uniform and then put it on again in 1775. Today, an officer would be technologically behind after 2 or 3 years out of the line. But in the 18th century, very little was changing in terms of theory and practice.
Washington accepted the assignment, knowing that if he failed, he would lose everything he had struggled so hard to gain. He would lose Mount Vernon. He would be arrested and hung as a traitor. There was no turning back. During the 8-year War of Independence, the troops of Washington's Continental Army were chronically underfed, underdressed, and undersupplied. The tales of barefoot soldiers leaving bloody footprints in the snow are not fiction. The hardships of Valley Forge in the winter of 1778 are not exaggerations. Once the makeshift cabins were built, the men were finally out of the freezing wind and blowing snow. But each sentry still had to borrow clothes from his bunkmates for his turn at the guard. As the guard rotated, so did the clothing. Deeply feeling the plight of his men, Washington constantly hounded the Continental Congress for supplies, trying to shame them by appealing to their sense of patriotism.
Obviously, there were tensions during the war between the Congress and the Army because Congress was weak. It had little power. It could do really very little to meet the Army's material needs. But Washington tried to inform the officers and enlisted men of the liabilities that Congress labored under. So Washington was really a kind of diplomat in a coalition war. He kind of held things together between a weak Congress and 13 independent states. And an army that was often disgruntled, and with good reason.
Congress's typical response was to give Washington permission to commandeer what he needed from those living near his bivouacked army. Washington refused this invitation to rob his fellow citizens at the point of a bayonet, arguing that to do so would alienate the very people in whose name the struggle had been undertaken. To fill his ranks, Washington turned slowly to the idea of desegregating his troops, urging that slaves be offered their freedom in return for service. He urged cooperation. As rebels, he said, quoting Ben Franklin, "Either we hang together or we hang separately." In the heat of battle, Washington was brilliant and courageous to a fault. Throughout his military career, Washington seemed charmed. On horseback, he led charges into the thick of battle, willfully exposed himself to cannon and musket fire, strolled through hail of shot, and made solo sorties. Yet not once did a bullet or shrapnel ever even graze him. During heavy shelling at Yorktown, Washington studied the British fortifications through his field glass as cannon shot whizzed past. Everyone dove for cover but Washington. He seemed immune or indifferent to danger. Finally, in 1781, with the help of the French and engineers who designed the siege works at Yorktown, the besieged British surrendered. When General Cornwallis asked for the terms, Washington replied that the same honors should be granted to the surrendering army as were granted to the garrison of Charleston. The point was not lost on Cornwallis. When Charleston fell to the British in 1780, the British had refused to grant the Americans the honors of war, treating them as rebels and not as a legitimate enemy. Washington now demanded the same humiliation of Cornwallis. But Cornwallis claimed illness and sent a stand-in to the surrender ceremony. In an attempted insult, the British stand-in tried to hand over Cornwallis's sword to a French officer who had fought with the Americans. But the Frenchman refused, directing him instead to General Washington. Washington also refused. He ordered the Englishman to surrender Cornwallis's sword to General Lincoln, who had been the American commander of the Charleston garrison. Argument has always raged over Washington's abilities as a general. By 18th century standards, he was an uninspired commander. Though Washington studied and conducted himself as a European-style commander, he never claimed to be more than he was. He saw himself as a citizen soldier, obliged to serve his countrymen in their time of need, answering the call of duty.
It's true that as a fighter, some of Washington's critics referred to him as a Fabian, as one who would not confront the enemy. But if you look at the record, he was actually a fighting general. On two or three occasions, he wanted to assault the British in Boston in the winter of 1775, 1776. He stayed in New York and fought the British in 1776 when being on Manhattan Island was really very precarious. Then he scored the little twin miracles at Trenton and Princeton, two aggressive encounters in the wintertime. He attacked the British rear guard at Monmouth. He was actually a fighting general. Now, it's true he didn't win many battles, but the Americans generally didn't win many big battles.
During his campaign against the British, Washington was always outnumbered, typically outgunned, and always short on supplies, weapons, wagons, horses, and boats. Yet he repeatedly slipped the British noose, choosing strategic retreat over honorable defeat. He doggedly wore his enemy down. The British lost the war not so much because the Americans under Washington defeated them on the battlefield, but because General George Washington would not give up or go away.
He wore the enemy down. He was persistent. He stayed after them. This was to a degree a war of attrition, and in this sense, the Americans had the advantage in that England was fighting 3,000 miles away from home in a period when there was not instantaneous communication or transportation. So in a sense, he knew what he was doing in wearing them down. Even his British victories were really Pyrrhic victories in almost every case. You think about the number of men they lost, and they were irreplaceable men.
Washington was the unanimous choice of the delegates to preside over the Constitutional Convention of 1787. By choice and custom, as president of the assembly, he rarely spoke during its sessions. Yet as the delegates debated the nature of a constitutional presidency, it was a foregone conclusion that Washington would be the natural choice to fill the office, whatever form it took. Since the best 18th century example of a stable government responsive to the people was the constitutional monarchy, there were those who thought Washington should become King of America. Others thought a new, titled American aristocracy should be created. Washington angrily opposed both notions. As the 55 delegates shaped their image of the presidency, they had before them, day after day, the image of George Washington on the dais, presiding over debate. Had anyone else been in that seat, the United States might well have had a cabinet government or a three-person executive appointed by the legislature. The choice of America's first electoral college was unanimous. Without seeking the position, George Washington, at age 57, had been chosen to lead his new nation as the first President of the United States. His journey north from his beloved Mount Vernon for the inauguration turned into a spontaneous, triumphal march for the whole nation. Ever aware of the need to add grace and dignity to the new government, Washington indulged in such pomp as he felt appropriate for a citizen hero. His critics suspected monarchical tendencies.
Washington was absolutely comfortable staying within the framework of the Anglo-American tradition of civil control of the military. Now, it is true, there were some Americans, probably just a handful, really, who felt that all the adulation that Washington received was unhealthy, that he might be tempted to exceed the bounds of propriety, to become a kind of Caesar, in other words. Washington, in one way, was like other famous revolutionaries, successful revolutionaries in modern history. Certainly different in that he had a healthy psyche. He didn't have a narcissus complex. He was no threat to the revolution. Because he was no threat, our revolutionary leaders died in their beds, and that was one of the remarkable things about our revolution.
Such was the sensitivity to this monarchical issue that it provoked a raging debate in the first days of the first Congress. A full week was spent trying to decide how the chief executive of their new government would be addressed. Among the proposals were His Highness, His Excellence, a mouth-bending His Highness the President of the United States and Protector of the same, His Mightiness, His Most Benign Highness, and His Elective Highness. They finally decided to refer to him simply as the President of the United States. Familiar as we now all are with Washington's face on our stamps and money, another vigorous debate broke out in the legislature when it was proposed to place Washington's profile on the newly minted coins. To many, this smacked of Caesarism, dictatorship, and royalty. In his place, a symbolic female liberty was embossed on the metal coins. His face would not appear on the dollar bill until the middle of the next century. Shortly after noon on April 30th, 1789, George Washington, wearing his dress sword and a brown broadcloth suit with white silk stockings, stood on a small balcony on the second floor of Federal Hall in New York. Looking down over the ebullient crowd that filled what would one day be the heart of American finance at Broad and Wall Streets in Lower Manhattan, he took the oath of office, swearing to the best of his ability to preserve, protect, and defend the newly ratified Constitution. As he addressed the combined Congress in his first inaugural, eyewitnesses describe him as grave, almost sad, and openly awed by the profound duties which he had just sworn to perform, having added to his oath the now traditional, "So help me God." With Washington swearing in, all the major pieces of the world's first constitutional democracy were now in place. The great experiment could now begin. Everything was new. There were no precedents for the protocols or proper procedures for governing. At his first afternoon reception, which was open to any well-dressed person, David Humphreys, Washington's aide, opened the parlor doors and announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States." Washington was so embarrassed that at all subsequent receptions he made a point of arriving early and alone and leaning on the fireplace mantel so that arriving visitors would find him already in place.
As president, he was very aware that everyone was watching what he did. He said that he saw himself as a figure upon the stage. And when you look at his public life versus his private life, you can see how that's true. As president, he saw it as his public duty to create precedents for the future of the office. He knew that people were watching everything he did. But then when he was off the stage or at home at Mount Vernon, he was a very different person. But he really saw himself as serving the public as this figure upon a stage.
One of Washington's most important roles in the great experiment was to establish the actual working form of the executive branch. Among other things, the president was constitutionally empowered to appoint a cabinet, ambassadors, public ministers, judges, and other federal officers. Washington made a point of appointing men on the basis of aptitude, residence, former service, and a willingness to see issues in a continental perspective. His appointments were uniquely nonpartisan, a dynamic mix of men from different regions and strongly divided points of view. It would be as if in today's world a president appointed left-wing Democrats, right-wing Republicans, merchant bankers, and labor leaders to the same cabinet. No president since has ever had such an intentionally diverse cabinet. The wonder is that Washington managed by sheer force of character to keep most of them together through two full terms. Martha Washington arrived in New York 1 month after her husband's first inauguration. While her entrance into the nation's capital lacked the spectacular scale of the president-elect's arrival, she too crossed the Hudson aboard the flashy presidential barge, with its 13 liveried oarsmen, each representing a different state. A 13-gun salute, the governor, and a huge crowd greeted her. Especially enthusiastic were the many veterans who remembered her as the kind, proud woman who had lived among them and made daily rounds of the hospitals in most of the Continental Army's miserable winter encampments. She brought them soup, medicine, comforting words, and a kind ear. To those who asked, she frequently slipped money. With genuine love and respect, the veterans called this matronly woman in her simple white dresses and caps Lady Washington. Her husband called her Patsy and referred to her as my amiable consort. In public, she called him General, and in private, Papa. Home alone, they fretted over their false teeth. His, made partly of hippopotamus ivory, never quite fit. Hers, of bone and metal, were only marginally better.
The question, of course, has been raised as to whether Washington was really in love with Martha and whether she was physically appealing. If you look at a painting of her just a few months before she married George, she looks quite attractive. And don't forget, in the 18th century, the ideal of beauty was different from what it became in the 19th and the 20th. To be slightly buxom, slightly plump, was highly desirable. In the 18th century. Now, you add to that, of course, the fact of her great wealth, which everybody knows. She was a very pleasant woman. Everybody who knew her over a 20-year period consistently talked about what a healthy psyche she had, what a nice person she was, what a good listener she was. I think it was probably a wonderful marriage.
You know, to those people who would say that maybe George didn't really love Martha very much, he invited her to spend every winter of the war with him. And if a man ever had an opportunity to stay away from his wife, that was it. And he simply did not take advantage of it. He loved her.
With the endless rounds of parties, receptions, and late dinners at which the new president was the guest of honor, and which protocol usually forbade Martha from attending, it was inevitable that rumors of the new president's supposed philandering grew. Generally inspired by his political enemies, none were so pervasive as the rumor that Washington, during his trip to Barbados with Lawrence as a 19-year-old, had fathered none other than the much-despised Federalist Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton. It was a well-known fact that Hamilton had indeed been born to an unwed mother. But it mattered little to the rumor-mongers that Hamilton wasn't born in Barbados, and that he'd been born in 1755, not 1752. Neither George nor Martha ever lowered themselves to comment on the subject. Washington staffed his official residence with 14 servants and 7 slaves. Like a third of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, Washington, too, was a slave owner. But unlike many of his contemporaries who defended slavery, Washington assumed that slavery debased both slave and slaveholder. As a Virginia planter, Washington hesitated to emancipate his slaves because he felt that life for free Africans in the plantation South would be more difficult than for those bonded to a humane household. Nobody, it seems, ever bothered to ask the slaves their preference. But as a temporary measure, Washington took extraordinary steps after the war, refusing to sell any slave without his or her consent, and refusing to separate self-declared slave families. He allowed them to raise and sell their own fruits and vegetables. And though he brought his slaves with him when the nation's capital moved from New York to Philadelphia during his first term as president, when he returned to Virginia in 1797 after his second term, he quite consciously left most of these slaves behind. Washington knew that Pennsylvania had a law limiting how long a slave could remain in the state. Once past the time limit, the slave was automatically freed. Washington's forgetfulness was, in fact, a discrete act of emancipation. Of all the so-called founding fathers, Washington was the only one to free his slaves, although he delayed formal manumission, official freedom, until after his death. In 1796, as Washington's second term was ending, he called on Alexander Hamilton to help him prepare a farewell address to the nation. It was never delivered by Washington, but it was published in newspapers across the country. In the address, Washington gave his reasons for refusing a third term as president. He harshly condemned the kind of partisan catfighting which had polarized his government into conservative pro-British Federalist and radical pro-French Republican camps. He urged his successors to protect the nation's credit and avoid lingering debt. And he especially warned against forming entangling alliances with foreign powers. Europe's interests were not America's. Ending his farewell address on what by now had become a characteristically Washingtonian note of apology, he wrote, "I shall also carry with me the hope that my country will never cease to view my defects and errors with indulgence, and that after 45 years of my life dedicated to its service with an upright zeal, the faults of incompetent abilities will be consigned to oblivion, as myself must soon be to the mansions of rest."
What was important about Washington's presidency in the long run? I would say several things. One, he had an appreciation for the Constitution and putting flesh on what was really a skeletal document. He fleshed out the office of the presidency, which in some ways was the most controversial and heatedly discussed aspect of the Constitution at the Constitutional Convention. He set important precedents in the domestic area with regard to relations with Congress, with the creation of the cabinet. And with regard to foreign policy, he made it very clear that the president, rather than the Senate, as some people wanted, would shape our relations with other countries.
In retirement, Washington tended to the work of his beloved Mount Vernon and received an endless stream of guests. He corresponded with those who continued the struggle of keeping the great experiment on course and free of the dangerous storms consuming Europe as the French Revolution reached ever more fevered and bloodier peaks. And he took time to attend to his personal life.
I think there was no doubt that Mount Vernon was a magnet for George Washington. Wherever he was thinking about it, he was talking about it, he was corresponding about it. I think it is what sustained him during the Revolution. Through all of those trying times, he sat down once a week and wrote to his manager and maintained that very strong tie with the place that he loved best. It really meant everything to him. It had been in the family since the 17th century and really was his ancestral home. And he developed it from the original 2,500 acres that the family owned to 8,000 contiguous acres.
After not seeing her for over 25 years, both Martha and George wrote letters of heartfelt friendship to Sally Fairfax. Now widowed for 11 years, Sally had been living in England since 1773. Wrote Washington, "My dear madam, 25 years nearly have passed away since I have considered myself as the permanent resident of this place. During this period, so many important events have occurred and such changes in men and things have taken place, as the compass of a letter would give you but an inadequate idea of. None of which events, however, nor all of them together, have been able to eradicate from my mind the recollection of those happy moments, the happiest in my life, which I have enjoyed in your company." He went on to wistfully suggest that Sally return to the land of her birth. Sally Fairfax never came back to the country her old friend had helped bring into existence. But in Washington's letter to her, he also wrote of a magnificent new city being built on the banks of the Potomac, a city which would become his nation's new capital. On December 12, 1799, Washington took his usual tour of Mount Vernon on horseback, riding 5 hours in hail, snow, and rain. The next day he stayed home, nursing a sore throat. By nightfall, he couldn't speak. A doctor was sent for. His condition began to deteriorate. He called for his secretary, Tobias Lear, and in private asked that he not be buried too quickly. He wanted to make sure that he wouldn't be buried alive. But ever conscious of decorum and dignity, he also did not want his funeral to turn into a spectacle. Lear promised that his wishes would be honored. Washington drew him closer and repeated his instructions to make absolutely certain that Lear had understood him. He had. Washington said, "'Tis well," closed his eyes, and died. When George Washington died at the age of 67, his friend and comrade-at-arms, Light Horse Harry Lee, eulogized him with the now familiar words, "First in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen." Never considered a great thinker or strategist, Washington's genius was leadership. Once set on a course of action, he pursued it to its end. He persevered. Patient, self-possessed, often cold and distant to others, he appealed to men's better angels, inspiring others to reach beyond their personal limitations and seize greatness. He understood power and used it wisely. There are those who praise Washington as America's only truly noble, nonpartisan, and innately virtuous president. He risked everything to command an army of revolution. Facing the world's greatest military power, he managed to keep his ill-equipped, poorly trained, undermanned army in the field till the end. He avoided defeat and thereby won the war. He left his stamp on the institution of the presidency, which in so many ways he invented. He steered the new nation through its first troubled decade, making it possible for the fledgling United States to mature without becoming embroiled in any foreign wars. The path of George Washington's life is one from frontier to capital, from periphery to center. And of all those who helped create the new nation, none perhaps are more deserving of the title, Founding Father.